You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The divide in our nation continues a day after President Trump's acquittal on charges of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Here's Chief Justice John Roberts presiding over the Senate trial.
Two-thirds of the senators present not having pronounced him guilty, the Senate adjudges that respondent Donald John Trump, President of the United States, is not guilty as charged in the second article of impeachment.
Will this moment have a long-lasting repercussions on our democracy? How will the divisions we see in the halls of power in Washington filter down to our communities? Is our system working the way our founders intended it to? We're at 800-642-1234. Jasmine Ferrier is chair and professor of the Political Science Department at the University of Louisville. Jasmine, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure.
So from your constitutional perspective, what was the significance of this acquittal on our country, on our democracy?
The constitutional significance is yet to be determined because impeachment is considered to be an extreme form of checks and balances. So it's unclear whether this will set a new standard that we will have partisan impeachments on a more regular basis, than perhaps the founders intended. We'll wait and see. Again, so if a Democratic president is elected with a Republican House, is this going to be the institutional routine?
You study the separations of power in our government. Does the president or Congress emerge stronger from this impeachment battle?
That's very hard to tell. And as a political scientist who has been chastened by poor predictions in the past, I will demur on what this means for the election this year. But again, the Constitution envisions a vibrant separation of power system that, frankly, is not supposed to go to the extreme of impeachment. Congress, by any stretch, has the vast majority of institutional powers that it needs to get its way if it's united and believes in its own institutional place. So again, Congress can reinvigorate the existing, quote, regular political, institutional, and constitutional powers against any president if it's united in trying to become more of a leader in the country's direction.
Throughout the impeachment process, President Trump did not comply with subpoenas from Congress for additional witnesses, additional documents. Is it unusual for a president to defy Congress in this way?
It is unusual, and Congress, including the leadership in the House, could have gone through the court system to demand compliance. That would bring a more fraught area into the question, because if the president defied a court order, then it would become a more three-branch separation of powers dilemma. In general, again, Congress has lots of ways to get the president to comply if it's united and tries other methods. So, for example, Congress can negotiate with the president regarding, in the Senate, any confirmation battles that are on the agenda. In the House, it can be regarding appropriations and budget processes. The president needs congressional authority, frankly, and money to do what he wants to do, as he laid out in his State of the Union address. So the system is not meant to be controlled unilaterally by one side, one party, or one branch, or even one person. So Congress needs to, again, think more united in their view of their place against the president. Of course, that's very hard to do when you have different parties in control of the House and Senate.
We're talking with political scientist Jasmine Ferrier. She wrote the book Constitutional Dysfunction on Trial, and we're exploring the ripple effects, what could emerge from the impeachment trial. You can join in 800-642-1234. Jasmine, one of the president's lawyers, Alan Dershowitz, argued that when the president does something that, quote, he believes will help him get elected in the public interest, that he cannot be impeached for that. What do you make of that view of executive power?
That's an extreme version of what President Nixon said. After he was out of office, if the president does it, it's not illegal. This is an argument that, frankly, a lot of modern presidents make, maybe not in the crystal clear way that Alan Dershowitz put it. But both Democratic and Republican presidents in the modern era conflate their personal interest, their policy interests, and the national interest routinely. When presidents talk about the national interest, they're talking about their interest. And their interest can include personal ambition as well as policy goals. this rhetoric, again, is perhaps a few shades beyond what is normal, but it's a version of the world that presidents say and see routinely. If you think about war powers, for example, even though this president is saying, I can do things that will help my reelection, we do wonder where previous presidents have used their power in the Oval Office to further their reelection in reality. Maybe they don't say it that way, but if they use war powers, budget powers, trade and tariff powers, immigration powers, these are all related to their electoral goals as well.
So it becomes increasingly difficult to tease out what's personal and what's policy.
It certainly is. And the Federalist Papers actually anticipated a version of this. Of course, again, not like the Dershowitz version. But Federalist Paper 51 says, and I'll paraphrase, that personal ambition should be wrapped up with institutional ambition using constitutional means. In other words, the Federalist Papers envisioned a society where, yes, you have ambitious politicians contending for power. They use their power through the checks and balances system. The wrinkle that we are missing today is that the branches are not all using them. The president is overwhelming Congress routinely by using powers without responses. So again, what the framers assumed in a checks and balances system is that all the branches would have a personal and electoral incentive to engage each other, not roll over for the president because he happens to be of the same party.
Jasmine, do you anticipate that impeachment will be used as a political weapon by the parties in the future?
That's exactly what I fear. It would be the equivalent of institutional gangland warfare, because we do not want the levers of constitutional power to be used as revenge tactics against the next administration. We've already seen miniature versions of that in the Senate. So just to quickly digress, Harry Reid, when he was the majority leader of the Senate, started blocking George W. Bush's judicial nominees. Then leader Mitch McConnell decided to use the same tactics against judicial nominees. And then leader McConnell ratcheted it up by failing to place any time in the Senate's calendar, either in the committee system or on the floor, for Merrick Garland's judicial nomination in 2016. So in return, when the Democrats return to power in the Senate, will they respond in kind? They will feel like suckers, pardon my language, unless they say, well, they're going to do the same things to the Republicans did to them. Let's move it over to the House. Will the next Democratic president facing an opposition House of Representatives be subject to impeachment? I'm not denying that there were causes for this investigation, but there's no question that the party is going to take this very, very personally, the Republican Party, and perhaps seek revenge when it's their institution's time to be in power.
Very quickly, before we have to let you go, how significant was it that Senator Mitt Romney defied his party by voting that President Trump was guilty on one charge?
It is very significant, but remember, Senator Romney answers to the majority of people in Utah. And I was looking this morning, there is a Tribune editorial for the Salt Lake Tribune, and it says Mitt Romney's profile and courage. I'm not sure what the other newspapers are saying, but again, he answers to his constituents, and that's the way that separation of powers thrives, because there is no one central authority. Everybody in Congress, in the House and Senate, is a winner. They won in their district in the House, and they won in their state in the Senate. They answer to their voters, and his next election is 2024. So Mitt Romney might get the cold shoulder from his Republican Party, but ultimately he will answer to the people of Utah.
Jasmine, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure. Anytime.
Jasmine Farrier is chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Louisville. And now we have U.S. Senator Ron Johnson on the line. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Senators closed the chapter on President Trump's Senate trial yesterday, capping a months-long process that started with an impeachment inquiry in the House that led to the president's impeachment, ultimately his acquittal yesterday. Senator Johnson voted to acquit on both charges. How do you feel about this moment? What do you want to ask Senator Johnson? We're at 800-642-1234. Ron Johnson is a Republican representing Wisconsin in the U.S. Senate, where he chairs the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Senator Johnson, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Morning, Kate. How you doing?
I'm doing well. You've said all along that what the president did was not an impeachable offense. Is there anything you still want answered in America's bilateral ties with Kiev and the president's dealings with Ukraine in light of withholding military aid and Russia aggression?
There are so many unanswered questions, but it goes way beyond just this particular episode. I think my primary point is this never should have risen to the level of impeachment inquiry, impeachment trial. Congressional oversight is completely appropriate. But in the end, in our system, and I think the primary check and balance on all elected officials are the voters. And here we are 9 months from a presidential election. Why not let the voters decide in this case? So, yeah, I've been conducting my oversight, starting with the Hillary Clinton email scandal, which somewhat morphed because the similar players, same players in the FBI, Department of Justice, were involved then in the false narrative of Trump campaign collusion with Russia. You've seen the abuse of the FISA court by certain officials in the FBI and Department of Justice. These are definitely concerns, but from my standpoint, it's about congressional oversight. It's about making these things transparent so the American people know what happens so they can factor that into their decisions when they go to the polls. We shouldn't be settling our disputes in a completely partisan impeachment process, which is what this was, which, by the way, is exactly what Speaker Pelosi and Chairman Nadler warned us about in their previous lives, I guess. So all of a sudden they decide, well, I guess a partisan impeachment is the way to go. I don't think it was. So I'm glad this chapter in American history is over.
Former National Security Advisor John Bolton may be subpoenaed by the House. You talked with him on January 7th. What do you want to know from Mr. Bolton?
Well, if he has things that are relevant, I think he should have just come out, you know, particularly in light of the fact that his book transcript was leaked selectively. Kind of suspicious timing there. But I spoke to John. You know, obviously, I made my information public. Now, but I'm not constrained by the very legitimate concern of executive privilege and deliberative process, the separation between powers. I'm in a separate branch, so I could very freely go out and tell the public what I knew about this particular episode. John is more constrained because he should respect and the president should protect executive privilege and deliberative process. It's incredibly important that presidents can rely on frank and sometimes out-of-the-box advice from advisors without people worrying about it being exposed because of congressional oversight. So these are important concepts, separation of powers, that need to be respected and, from my standpoint, protected.
Well, let's take a call now. Frank is joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Frank.
Hi, good morning.
Go ahead. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I guess kind of in pretense to this, I'll tell you that I'm Republican and, you know, I voted for Trump. And in a way, I empathize with the Republicans in the Senate because it was almost a lose-lose situation for them. If they did vote Trump guilty and pull him out, then the base of voters would be very upset given the narrative that was being pushed. But I guess my problem is if he is truly guilty and he's under this mindset now, you know, there would be no way for us to know without witnesses. So their backs were against the wall. You know, if it was voted to acquit and then something else does happen, everybody who voted to acquit is going to be put under question for not allowing witnesses. So I guess my question to Ron Johnson was, you know, if he was truly out of the or in the clear, so to speak, and we as a voter base needed assurances on that, what problem do witnesses pose or would they have posed if there was truly no issue?
Senator Johnson?
Well, again, I take the position we never should have even been in an impeachment trial. Calling witnesses would have extended this well into the election season. It would not have told us anything more we need to know because, first of all, you look at the articles themselves, and from my standpoint, they're not impeachable offenses. So there was no reason to call additional witnesses, but it's just false that there weren't witnesses. The House called and presented 13 witnesses over 100 clips in the Senate. We saw all that information. I sat through all of it. We didn't need more information to come to the conclusion that these were not impeachable offenses. No matter what additional information came out, they weren't impeachable offenses. So why prolong the process?
Your colleague, Republican Senator Mitt Romney of Utah, voted to convict President Trump on the abuse of power charge. So he's first senator to vote to remove a president of his own party. What was your reaction to Romney's vote?
First of all, I respect Mitt. I don't believe there's any grandstanding in this at all. I think this is clearly what he felt in his heart. I just fundamentally disagreed with his position that he took on this. So, again, I don't believe there's going to be any retribution within the Republican conference. I've heard, you know, all kinds of things, but I think we all respected Mitt's decision on this one, and we just fundamentally disagreed.
Let's go to Fred now in Ithaca. Fred, hi.
Yeah, I am just calling to let you know that I'm a Christian in the state of Wisconsin. Since Act 10, I've struggled voting Republican anymore in the state of Wisconsin because I just don't understand the dictatorship that's happened in our state when we strip our governor of all of his rights. Is that what the Christian people would like if they had taken over the post? So what's happening in D.C. is, in my opinion, been led by many of our Wisconsin Republican Christian people. And to me, Mitt's morals matter. Mr. Johnson said his mental capacity doesn't allow him to support.
And Fred,
but just 1 second. John McCain is another person that had character. I don't think there's any character left in the Republican Party in the state of Wisconsin.
Fred, thanks for the call. Senator Johnson, how does this impact ideology here, and how does it filter down to Wisconsin?
I'm not sure there's actually a question in any of that whatsoever. There's a huge divide in this nation. There's no doubt about it. And it doesn't help when everybody is questioning the other person's motives. You know, I ran for office because I was concerned about the future of this nation, the fact that we were piling up debt, which is something that both parties continue to ignore. I always try and concentrate on the areas of agreement. I truly believe as every American shares the same goal. We want safety, we want security, we want greater prosperity and greater opportunity for every American. I try and concentrate on those goals, try and actually get something accomplished. And, you know, I don't question the other side's motives. I certainly question their policies. I don't agree with their policies, but I try and concentrate on the areas of agreement to actually accomplish something. It's my manufacturing background, continuous improvement. So, again, I don't know where that gentleman was coming from. But you know, from my standpoint, I'm just trying to do the right thing.
We're talking with U.S. Senator Ron Johnson a day after President Trump's acquittal in the Senate. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234. Senator, will this impeachment trial open the door to future impeachments? Do you see impeachment being used in the future as a political force, a political weapon?
Well, it's one of the points that Ken Starr made in his presentation, that we're in the age of impeachment right now, and that's not good for our democracy. So I think one of the things that Republicans in the Senate, by voting not guilty, we're trying to do is send a very strong signal to future houses, don't do this. Follow the advice of Nancy Pelosi and Chairman Nadler. Chairman Nadler said there must never be an impeachment substantially supported by one of our major political parties and largely opposed by the other. Such an impeachment would lack legitimacy, would produce divisiveness and bitterness in politics for years to come. I wish Nancy Pelosi and Chairman Nadler would have followed their own advice. And so one of the things that we were trying to do is shut down that process. Don't send the Senate a completely partisan impeachment and then ask the Senate to do your investigatory work. Again, oversight is fine. Public exposure is necessary. Transparency is necessary, but don't weaponize this constitutional nuclear weapon. So I'm literally hoping through my vote, I contributed to shutting down this weaponization and politicization of the impeachment process.
The talk of censure has been floated, a formal statement of disapproval, purpose of censure to discredit both the president's act and the motive behind it. You said that you would not support censure. Can you basically have some comment on that? What would you say there?
Well, again, if censure was a serious proposal, it's something the House could have seriously considered, but they didn't. They weaponized this. They went right to the nuclear option of constitutional conflict. It's not going to happen in the Senate. I mean, that vote will not come up in the Senate, so why even talk about it? If the House wanted to do that, they could have done that. They could have stopped short of dragging America through, again, a highly partisan, highly politicized impeachment, which they shouldn't have done.
Let's go to Troy now in Muskego. Hi, Troy.
Yes, two things. The main thing is the witnesses. Number one, the White House blocked witnesses. And then two, the senators, Ron Johnson included, voted not to allow witness to testify. And I kind of feel like, you know, he uses that terminology a lot, talking about how he represents Wisconsin. Well, I wanted to see witnesses testify. And I'm pretty sure the majority of people in Wisconsin wanted to see these witnesses testify. So I don't know how they live with that they didn't even – they blocked people from testifying, and then they want to – the president's going to supposedly celebrate today that, you know, that he had a victory when he blocked witnesses.
Troy, thanks for the call. Senator Johnson, there still is, as Troy is saying here, a need and want for more witnesses.
So I wonder where Troy's outrage was when the president wasn't afforded calling witnesses in the House impeachment trial or in the House impeachment process. You know, one of the things that the White House counsel pointed out is, okay, if we go down the impeachment road, we never had the due process ability to question the House, the people who are called in by the House managers. So we would have gone down that list. I mean, this would have stretched on for months. And again, I take the position these were unimpeachable offenses. We never should have been in this process, so why prolong it? But again, anybody outraged that the Senate didn't call witnesses, we heard from the House witnesses there was no due process afforded in the House. The House did not allow the president to call his witnesses in their process. So, you know, have a little balance, a little fairness in your attitude here.
Senator Johnson, thank you for joining us.
Have a great day.
Ron Johnson is a Republican representing Wisconsin in the Senate. We also reached out to Senator Tammy Baldwin, who voted to remove President Trump, and she was not available. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the state of the Federal Election Commission. This agency is tasked with regulating federal campaign finance laws and elections, but it can no longer carry out its official capacity, no longer do its job after the resignation last summer of a commissioner that left it without the necessary four-person quorum. So what questions do you have about the FEC and how it operates? Do you have questions about how commissioners are appointed? How do you feel about the FEC operating without a quorum? We're at 800-642-1234. Dave Leventhal is editor-at-large for the Washington, D.C.-based Center for Public Integrity. He has been reporting on the FEC. Dave, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks for having me, Kate.
So what are some of the high-level actions that the Federal Election Commission, the FEC, is incapable of doing that right now without its quorum?
Well, because the FEC simply doesn't have enough commissioners in place to have that quorum that you mentioned, it can't enforce federal campaign finance laws. It has had to effectively cancel all of its public meetings, and we're now up to about 10 of them since September 1st when it lost that quorum. And there's lots of other high-level business that the FEC can't attend to because it doesn't have that quorum, and that includes punishing election scofflaws, people who are doing the wrong thing or violating the law in the estimation of an FEC that can't make that determination. And this is also important, too. It can't provide official advice to candidates or other types of political actors, such as political action committees, that are just simply seeking to comply with federal campaign finance laws and other laws, which, you know, it's important to note that most want to comply with the law. They want to do the right thing.
So it can no longer right now be a resource for compliance in election law?
That's true. And this is something that has manifested itself in several different ways. Most recently, a congressional candidate in Georgia. She wants to ask the FEC if she can use campaign funds to pay for her health care, which she's had to give up in order to run for Congress. She had to quit her job, and she wants the FEC to make a ruling, an official ruling, on whether she and, frankly, any other candidate, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, could dip into their campaign coffer and pay for their own health insurance. That seems, you know, relatively relevant given all the talk about health care and coverage and whatnot. But the FEC is not in a position right now because of that lack of quorum to make a ruling on that. So she's basically going to have to either go ahead and do it and potentially get fined for it or otherwise penalized once the FEC reconstitutes itself, or she's just going to have to go without health care, which is also a potential issue, too.
So they couldn't answer that congressional candidate's the congressional candidate's question on health care there and whether to be able to use campaign funds. Are there other low-level actions that the agency is still able to perform?
There is. So the FEC, it's a regulatory body, and it was formed right in the aftermath of Watergate, in fact, in 1975, to deal with a variety of things, not only enforcing campaign finance laws, but providing transparency for the campaign finance process. And that includes making sure that all the candidates and all the political committees out there are filing regular reports and disclosing how much money they're bringing in, how much money they are spending, if they have debt. And the FEC is continuing to do that function, continuing to play that role. So, for example, just a couple of days ago, all the presidential candidates who are running, all the congressional candidates who are running, had to file reports that pretty much brought us through the end of December on exactly what I just laid out, how much they've spent, how much they've raised. And the FEC was right at the tip of the spear in making sure that those reports got out into the public domain. But beyond that, when it comes to, well, hey, somebody filed their report incorrectly, or based on their report, it's pretty clear that they might be in violation of the law, the FEC is not in a position now to take that next step and actually enforce the law that is on the books for all of these different types of political candidates and committees who are supposed to be overseen by the FEC.
So if a campaign makes a misstep in a campaign finance law, are there potential fines here at risk?
Absolutely. And the FEC has the power as a civil agency to fine committees that do violate campaign finance laws. The FEC is not a criminal enforcer of laws. There's no FEC police, per se. And the Department of Justice, in fact, still has that ability if somebody's doing something that's so egregious or there's suspicion of somebody doing something really beyond the pale, the Department of Justice still can go after those candidates or those political committees. But pretty much, you know, most of the issues that fall in the realm of campaign money and campaign finance are the purview of the FEC. And again, the FEC is not in a position to put that law enforcer hat on and actually go and fully investigate and ultimately punish those who are doing the wrong thing.
We're talking about the Federal Election Commission and its inability to police campaign spending, other election issues as well. Our guide is Dave Leventhal from the Center for Public Integrity. What questions do you have about the FEC? What do you want to know about how it operates? Do you have questions about how commissioners are appointed? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Dave, do candidates have any alternatives right now, like going to another agency or through the courts to weigh in on the questions they have that come up in their campaigns?
Theoretically, yes. If a candidate really wanted to get a ruling from some governmental body about a question that they had about how to run their campaign, they could potentially petition a federal court, although that takes a lot of time. It could be fairly expensive, and there hasn't seemed to be too much of an appetite from anyone, at least at this point, to take that route. Usually they go the route of the FEC because it's fairly efficient when the FEC is operating, and they can get an answer pretty quickly to a question that is oftentimes very time sensitive, given that campaigns only last for so long. We know when the election date's coming up, and it's coming up in November, or primaries, which are coming up even sooner. So really what's probably going to happen for any candidate that does have a question that it wants to get answered from the FEC is it's just going to have to take a risk at this point. It's either going to have to do the thing it wants to do or not, potentially at its peril.
So let's look at who's around the table at the FEC. There are six commissioners. It needs four to establish a quorum. How long has the commission been without a quorum?
Commission's been without a quorum since September 1st of last year. So now we're in our sixth month of the FEC not having any ability to carry out its high-level functions. And there really is no end in sight. As it is right now, as you mentioned, there are six commissioners on the FEC, or six commissioner slots. Three of those are vacant, and the other three are filled by commissioners who themselves have long overserved what's supposed to be a single six-year term for each commissioner. Collectively, those three remaining commissioners have served more than 30 years beyond the expiration of their six-year term. So they theoretically should have been gone a long time ago. They're still there in what's called holdover status. And the question I get a lot is, well, wait, who's responsible for this? Who should be naming new commissioners? And the answer to that is Donald Trump and Donald Trump alone. The president of the United States, be it Donald Trump or previously Barack Obama, George W. Bush, alone has the responsibility and the right to name new commissioners, to nominate new commissioners. And then the U.S. Senate, in turn, has to go and approve those commissioners. At this moment, Donald Trump has zero FEC nominees pending before the U.S. Senate. He talked a very strong game, for example, during the State of the Union address, Donald Trump did, about judicial nominees that he's put forward, and he's very proud of that. At the same time, he has not made any nominees this calendar year for the Federal Election Commission. And that's curious, too, in the sense that Donald Trump has active complaints against his 2020 reelection campaign pending before the FEC that can't be dealt with by the FEC because Donald Trump himself is not not nominating new commissioners.
But he did make a nomination in 2017, Texas attorney Trey Traynor, a Republican. What happened there?
He did, and then he renominated him and renominated him again. But Trey Traynor's nomination has lapsed because the U.S. Senate has decided not to take up that nomination. Traditionally, the Senate has liked to take up nominations in pairs, and it's important to note that the FEC is a bipartisan agency. It's not controlled by Republicans or Democrats at any given time, and that at least three commissioners, or I should say a maximum of three commissioners, can only be from one party. So traditionally, there's been three Democrats or three Republicans. Maybe you'd have an independent in there, but somebody who caucused with one side or another. And because Donald Trump had not nominated a Democratic nominee to serve on that bipartisan agency, the Senate just couldn't come to an agreement to move forward. Trey Traynor, mind you now, his nomination has lapsed, and that's why we don't at this point have any nominees before the Senate, because Donald Trump hasn't renominated him or nominated anyone else.
Has the White House explained this, explained President Trump's rationale for not making a nomination to fill these vacant seats?
They have, and I've spoken to the White House, and the answer that I got on that very issue is that the White House at this point, if you take them at their word, wants to renominate all commissioners, or should I say get rid of the three remaining commissioners and fill the three slots that are open. I misspoke there. The U.S. Senate wants that to happen, and the White House wants only simply one commissioner to be taken up, Trey Traynor. So as a result, the White House, at least until Trey Traynor's nomination lapsed, just wanted the Senate to go and push him through and didn't want to deal with anything else. The U.S. Senate wanted to go and basically get a whole new slate, at least on the Republican side. And then the Democrats, they wanted just kind of what the White House wanted, in fact. So it's kind of this odd, strange three-way dance that's taking place where the parties who are doing the dancing can't really agree with one another.
Talking about the FEC efforts to fill all six commissioner seats, Dave Leventhal from the Center for Public Integrity is with us. How would you change the management of the Federal Election Commission? Who do you think should oversee this watchdog agency? What do you want to know about the FEC's operations in an election year? Join in with your questions, your insights, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment with Dave Leventhal right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the Federal Election Commission, the FEC, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Without a quorum, the FEC is unable to monitor compliance with election laws. The agency also can't vote on investigations, provide guidance, or conduct audits. So what do you want to know about the FEC's operations in an election year? Are you concerned about the agency's policing of campaigns? Do you feel that campaigns for federal officers are operating under the same set of rules? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dave Leventhal is editor-at-large for the Washington, D.C.-based Center for Public Integrity, and he stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Peter is joining us from Madison. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Thanks for having this topic. It's a very interesting and very timely topic. My question is, do complaints ever time out, so to speak? So whether President Trump is reelected or not, when they get a quorum, would the complaint against him still be ruled on, or do they just kind of expire because it's maybe not relevant anymore?
Thanks, Peter. Dave?
It's a great question, and the answer is yes, that complaints can time out. So, for example, there are some complaints right now that, in dozens, in fact, that are at risk during this calendar year of timing out from previous elections. If the FEC isn't there to rule, there's typically 5 years that the FEC has to make a ruling and make a determination. And so that's one issue. We could have them basically reach a statute of limitations, so to speak. Also, too, there's the other issue of complaints that have been made during the 2020 election cycle. There's almost no chance of them getting dealt with in real time or anything close to that. You're looking at complaints that have been made in the 2020 election cycle, probably getting dealt with sometime a year, two, even three or four from now. And those campaigns are going to be well and done by the time that the FEC gets around to making a determination one way or another.
Peter, thanks for the call. Dave, are the three remaining commissioners expected to leave anytime soon?
It's a possibility. I've talked to all three of them. I've gotten responses from two of them, one in particular, Ellen Weintraub. She's a Democrat. She was the chairwoman last year. She's gone back to just being a garden variety commissioner this year. She's been there since 2002. She said, hey, I can't really give you an answer. And then Caroline Hunter, who's a Republican, when I posed the same question to her, she made no commitment as to whether she would stay until the end of the year. Right now, she is the chairwoman, even though she doesn't have necessarily a lot to do as a chairwoman. But it could be a situation where the FEC actually loses additional commissioners before it gains new commissioners.
So do these commissioners leave for personal reasons, for other interests, to go into private law? What happens to them?
It depends on each commissioner. For example, Matthew Peterson, a Republican, he was the commissioner who left that created this lack of a quorum back on September 1st. He went into private practice. There are other commissioners who've taken different routes. One notable one would be Ann Ravel, a Democrat who is very in the public, oftentimes like to do a lot of TV and a lot of radio, definitely the face and the voice of the FEC for a while. And she's running for state Senate in California. So some people go into private practice, some go into politics, some don't do a whole lot after all and retire, which has been the case with at least a couple of commissioners as well.
We're discussing the FEC, the status of it, and its ability to police campaigns as we get closer to the 2020 election season. Our guide is Dave Leventhal from the Center for Public Integrity. Still time for your questions on the FEC, 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR. At mornings at WPR.org. You reported, Dave, that prominent election attorneys and campaign watchdog organizations are openly at odds over how the FEC should be relaunched, rebooted. What is at the heart of that debate?
It kind of goes back to what we talked about in the previous segment, which is the notion of, hey, the president and the Senate could just ram through one commissioner nominee who would basically get the FEC back to having a quorum so that it could conduct business. Now, the FEC has never in recent years been some sort of Shangri-La of bipartisanship. There's been a significant philosophical divide on the FEC, with Republicans generally saying that the FEC has done a lot of regulatory overreach and has tried to, and that they want to protect the First Amendment, making sure that political actors of all sorts can basically speak freely during elections and not have a lot of restrictions. Democrats feel that, no, in fact, that the FEC has done a bad job policing campaign finance. So that's kind of one consideration. The other consideration is the notion that since there are three vacancies and three commissioners who have long overstayed their terms, that the FEC just needs a clean sweep, that you need six new commissioners in there, ones who can start from the ground up. They can build their own rapport with each other, and they can begin to form a new FEC. And then I would add, Kate, a third kind of option that a lot of Democrats in particular are pushing, which is that the FEC itself needs to change, that instead of having a bipartisan commission where no one side really has providence over the other, that it should be a five-member commission, or it should be something else where there are going to be decisions made with greater efficiency, that we won't have what we've seen a lot of this past decade, which are deadlocks on very high-profile cases where the FEC hasn't even been able to come to a ruling because it couldn't get a minimum of four commissioners to agree on any one thing.
Yeah, we're seeing echoes here, I think, at the federal level as we look at what's going on with Wisconsin State Elections Commission. It's designed so half of its members are appointed by Democrats, half are appointed by Republicans. What is the political composition like then, and how productive can an agency be if it is split like that?
Generally, you're going to have an agency that isn't going to necessarily take as many decisive actions on really thorny political issues. And that's much to a lot of Democrats' chagrin who want to see an agency like the FEC or state-level agencies, be it in Wisconsin or Texas or anywhere else, really come down on people or political committees that that are violating the law or have been determined to violate the law. But the counterpoint to that is that if you have an agency that is controlled by Republicans or controlled by Democrats, even if it's for a temporary period of time, that they're really going to play politics when it comes to political issues that affect both parties. And that instead of that agency being some sort of a very neutral arbiter of what's right and what's wrong, they're going to use that agency as a political weapon against an opponent. And you hear that from Republicans a lot, that that's a major concern of theirs, especially if Democrats get in control, that they're just going to try to go after Republicans all the time. Is either side right? Well, who really knows? But at the same time, too, those are the concerns that are keeping the FEC from really changing, because there has to almost be bipartisan agreement for the FEC to change. And we just haven't gotten anywhere close to that yet here in Washington, D.C.
You were looking through FEC filings yesterday and found that Scott Walker's 2016 presidential campaign committee is still active. And the committee paid $40,000 in legal fees over the last several months, of 2019. What is notable there?
What's notable is that we have a lot of political committees, whether it's Scott Walker's presidential committee from 2016, Newt Gingrich's political presidential committee from 2012 would be another example of campaigns that just have that are, number one, still open, technically, even if their named candidate is not running and hasn't run for years, and that a lot of them still have a lot of debt or are still taking actions to spend money, whether it's in a legal context, a political context. And the FEC has been relatively outspoken on the issue of campaigns that are no longer active closing down, getting rid of that money, which they could do in a number of ways, donate it to charities, give it to other political committees. But you sort of have a lot of these zombie political campaigns and committees that exist out there, and one just so happens to be in your own state of Wisconsin as well.
Dave, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dave Leventhal is editor-at-large for the Washington, D.C.-based Center for Public Integrity, and we've been talking about his reporting on the Federal Election Commission. Just ahead, we look at placebos, how they're used in science and medicine, as researchers are fascinated with understanding how placebos or fake drugs can sometimes have dramatic consequences on our health. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.